From the Sky News Centre at 5, TalkTalks received a ransom demand from someone claiming to have launched a cyber attack against the company. Emma Jones has more.
It's the third time TalkTalk has been hacked this year. 4 million customers could be affected, including John Rampton.
As far as I know, some of the passwords and some of the other information wasn't encrypted by the company.
TalkTalk's boss admits she doesn't know what was stolen.
I've got experts reviewing the scale of the breach as we speak.
Cybersecurity expert Emily Orton reckons firms are too naive.
If you're an attacker and you're sophisticated and you're wanting to get onto someone's network, you will find a way.
The regulator admits TalkTalk could face a bigger fine if private information was not encrypted.
It's understood a three-year-old boy is among the victims of a bus crash in southwest France, which killed at least 43 people. He was travelling with his father, whose lorry crashed into a coach carrying pensioners heading on a day trip near Bordeaux. What could be the world's third most powerful hurricane of all time is hours away from making landfall in Mexico. People on the country's Pacific coast are being told to shelter ahead of Patricia's arrival. Gordon Johnston is on holiday in the resort of Puerto Vallarta and has been moved into the lobby of his hotel for safety. He says they're expecting a big one.
It could be a grade 5. The waves could be as high as the third floor. They've handed out toilet paper and toiletries and pillows, so I wouldn't expect it's going to be that comfortable.
A report into the Glasgow police helicopter crash says the pilot didn't respond to low fuel warnings and failed to follow emergency procedures. The aircraft came down onto the roof of the Clutha pub in 2013, killing 10 people. Workers in Scunthorpe made redundant by Tata Steel as a share in a £9 million support package. The Indian firm's pledged a further £1.5 million for Scottish employees who've lost their jobs. And England's cricketers have left the second test against Pakistan nicely poised at the end of the second day. Alistair Cook's men closed on 182 for 3. They trail by 196 runs. That's the latest. I'm Tom Harrigan.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's weekly politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, as the latest James Bond film, Spectre, hits the big screens, we take a deeper look at senior wartime naval intelligence officer, 007 author Ian Fleming, and where many now believe his James Bond name originated, a top secret mission in the closing days of World War II to snatch Hitler's treasurer from under the noses of the Russians, and with him billions of dollars in looted gold and other valuables. Plus, as a part of our tribute to veteran MP Michael Meacher, who died this week, we hear him talk about oil and how the project for a new American century and used it to help America to take over the world, using the war on terror as a pretext. Also, is the British royal family a cult? That's what dying Australian Diana assassination author John Morgan believes, and he should know he managed to escape from one. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and rain in the early hours. This weekend, temperatures are up to 14 Celsius, a little warmer. Showers on Saturday with colder but clearer conditions in the evening. Sunnier, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers and some gusty winds. Next weekend, that's the 31st of October and the 1st of November, Halloween show. I'm looking forward to that. Highs of 14 Celsius, mainly cloudy with some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith. Hi, Jenny.
Hello.
Welcome to the politics show. Tell us a bit about your entry to politics. What floats your boat politically and why the Labour Party?
I came from a Labour family. My father came out with the general strike and walked 65 miles afterwards to get a job because he hadn't got to venture. My mother and grandmother went to Pankhurst sewing class in the East End of London and could talk about the history of the East End
What was the Pankhurst sewing class then?
It was to teach working women to be able to have independent finance, which my grandmother needed because she had seven children when a husband that was an alcoholic. So there had to be some more money coming into the family, otherwise the children weren't going to get fed. The firm that my grandfather was with moved down to Berkshire, and half the family went with him, so the children were taken out of the centre of London and put into a rural background. So I grew up in a really nice... But the reason I got into politics in Bristol was I was asked to do so by the voluntary services. I was...
What do you mean by the voluntary services? Who are they?
Well, I was working a volunteer at that time with the Bristol Council of Voluntary Service. I'd been pulled in to help with the Cyrenians who had a soup kitchen down in St Paul's. So I started to get involved with it. And they were having trouble with some of the funding for some of the voluntary groups in the city.
Well,
and I was
like
asked to go in.
Something's happening still now, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And I walked in the door into something I really wasn't prepared for, but it was a learning ground of what was going on in the city, who was who were the nice ones, who were the nasty ones. Let's be quite honest, politicians come in every colour, creed and kind, really. And I think it was the turning ground for myself, because I then had to decide. I wasn't educated, I'd left school at 15 and a half, so I started to go to Bristol South College. I worked my way through the poly as it was in those days. I've gone back, now it's UE and got a degree, and to me it changed my life. But at the same time, I hope what I've learnt, I've been able to give back to the communities of this city.
So why did just getting an education change your life?
Well, I had to learn how the other half thought, didn't I? And I also had to have the knowledge to help people. If I was going to be an advice worker, if I was going to work in the deep end, I had to have the ability to assimilate legislation and law and benefits, regulations, things that I wasn't capable of, but I am now.
So tell us a bit about your job as a councillor, because I think you'll probably find that some councillors do more, some councillors do less, but there are members of the public calling you up quite a bit, aren't they, saying, well, look, I've had a problem here, usually with some sort of authority, some part of the government that you're there to help, supposed to be anyway, to help sort out.
Yes, I've always tried to be honest with people if I can't help them, but tried to find somewhere who could help them instead. I've done 11,700 odd cases in my ward. I know my ward backwards, and I know they know me. We respect each other, and that's the most important thing. And it's right across the board. You can't say what a normal case is that walks in on councillors. There's no such thing. It can be anything from benefits to housing to planning to street lights to dog poo. It's... And also highways, buses. So the more I do, I say that they give me something back each time, because each case I have to research and find out about, I'm learning, and every time I learn something, I widen my scope of understanding of how I should be as a councillor.
Tell us a bit about Southmead, because there's a big council estate there. Aren't there? I know I was reading in The Guardian yesterday, I think it was, that the government are now talking alongside Mayor Boris Johnson in London of actually demolishing some big council estates in London. And some would say that's a good thing, because they've been there for nearly 100 years, some of them, and just selling this land off to developers. I mean, do you think that's feasible happening here in Bristol?
I think it's absolutely horrendous. You're destroying communities, some of which go back three or four generations. There is strength in communities. They help each other. They understand what's going on. And they are the ones that really bring about the change.
But don't people rob off each other as well? I mean, just, I mean, you'll have, surely for every good neighbour, there's a bad one too.
No, And it's no, a very small percentage of people are really the ones that cause problems. The rest are the salt of the earth in some of our council estates, and nobody ever gives them an award or says how good they are. They put up sometimes with things that no one else in middle class areas would do, and they try to sort it out themselves.
Well, what sort of things? What do you mean?
Well, the neighbours that keep dogs that are trying to attack people. I knew a woman that in one of the areas of South Mead who knew that children were running the streets unfed and fed them, who looked after them, who took them in to see the pigeons in the back garden so that the children had conversations with adults. In other words, other adults getting involved in bringing up children. You don't choose who your mother and father are. And I think people forget that, and they blame the children for what they become. The best thing to do is to have adults around that have the strength to talk to them and encourage them and give them a hope that there's a different world that they can walk away to one day.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because this week the counter-extremism strategy has been run out by Prime Minister David Cameron, and one of the things he's saying is that there are lots of people out there who he considers as sort of extremists, and we've got to take great measures to make sure that children are kept away from them. What do you think about that?
I think most people aren't extremists. They get one or two. But you must remember that the way things are at the moment, I worry about the fact that we could have extremist politics coming in because this government aren't listening.
Through the central government. Yes. So it's interesting, isn't it? David Cameron accusing people of being extremists, but actually possibly he's one himself.
Yes, I think he is an extreme. He's at the far part of the pendulum, as it were, that's swinging and completely on the right wing with very little knowledge of how most of us live and very little caring even, which is so worrying at the moment, because what we need is to support each other through these bad times and help sort it out calmly and sensibly.
Now, you mentioning the extreme right wing of the Conservative Party, I'm not sure quite how extreme David Cameron goes, but anyway, last Saturday here in Bristol, just something from the Bath Chronicle actually here reporting on it, clash over immigration turns violent in Bristol, regional news, clash over immigration turns violent between protest groups over immigration in Bristol on Saturday. Police were called to quell the angry exchanges between two groups calling themselves the Bristol United Patriots and Bristol Anti-Fascists. More than 30 police officers, including a dog team, four officers on horseback, dashed to the scene in the centre of the city. Several people from both protest groups were arrested during the incident on Saturday afternoon, that's 17th of October. Scuffles broke out in College Green, Millennium Square, after a protest was organised by BUP, this is Bristol United Patriots members, who claim they stand against the building of mosques and against Islamic education centres. Now, apparently, this was raging around College Green in that area, and even with guests at the Marriott Hotel there watching out of the window and finding that their hotel was being surrounded by this kind of riot. Did get some information from the police about arrests and that sort of thing, and I'm just looking now, I think there were six or seven arrests. One person's been named, that's Kelly Marie Dixon, of No Fixed Abode, charged with assaulting an officer in the execution of their duty. We've also got a 21-year-old man arrested for a fray, 31-year-old for actual bodily harm. He's been released on police bail, 50-year-old man arrested for a fray. Now, this is starting to look a bit nasty, isn't it? And certainly my information is quite a few of these Bristol, although it's called Bristol United Patriots, aren't from Bristol at all. They bust in.
They came in, yes. Violence proves solves nothing. It never has and never will. And when you think about it, they are young people, and that their criminal background now will haunt them for the rest of their life. And I worry about the young. The young sometimes have short fuses and go and do some pretty silly things, which they then live the rest of their lives regretting. There are other ways of solving this. As I showed you and Martin just before we came on air, the number of immigrants coming into this city is dropping dramatically. What we now have are people who live here, who are born here, who have family connections, and who are originally from other parts of the world, but they are more and more integrating into our communities, and that's the strength of a diverse community, which we don't seem to have realise is happening. I think it's about time we thought about talking about this and discussing it, not sweeping it under the table, and trying to acknowledge that we are in a different time and a different place, and the future of this city is about everybody, no matter what religion, no matter what sexuality, no matter what background they have, that if we all work together, we can make this one of the best cities in the country.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, one thing that wasn't reported was an incident, specifically anyway, was an incident later in the evening, where the fascists had been going round bars in the city centre, seeing if they could find anyone they recognised from earlier in the day, and they did. Fighting started again, there was a small running battle later in the evening that spread from the waterside over to Bedminster. At least one anti-fascist, who was singled out by these fascists later in the day, ended up with a broken jaw. I noticed also that the anti-fascist statement said, "We plan to directly confront their racism, hatred and attempt to divide our class with a simple message. There are enough homes in this rich country of ours for everyone."
That's just polarising, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that's the on the Facebook page of the Bristol United Patriots, they say, we're against mass immigration, believe this to be a tactic for the end game of white genocide. That's big language, isn't it? White genocide. They stand against the building of mosques and Islamic education centres, and they claim to be on the side of Western values. Well, I think that my Western values, my English values, despise their values, and you know, they represent nobody but themselves. But of course, there is a real danger at a time of economic hardship that this kind of divisive politics will get a hold, both in all communities, and we all know where that can lead if we have any imagination.
Also, as a sort of suppose a side issue to this, we've got the struggle over the control of the police with the chief constable. I think I've been doing a little reading around this with Nick Gargan, the former chief constable, who was then suspended, and even after the investigation into allegations against him found there was not a sackable offence here, and the judge ruled that he should get his job back. The Police and Crime Commission have decided that he should go, and he's finally gone. This time last week, roughly. But Sue Mount Stephens' big mistake, I think, was former Chief Constable Colin Port led the campaign to oust Nick Gargan. Was it a good idea for Police Commissioner Sue Mount Stephens to rely on legal advice from the same lawyer who'd been employed by Chief Constable Colin Port, who she'd just sacked? So she used the same lawyer as the former Chief Constable Colin Port on the good old police authority, John Smith. Also, there were threats from the Colin Port camp against journalists, which I find rather irritating. Colin Port had support of Avon and Somerset, NARPO, which is National Association of Retired Police Officers, in his campaign against Nick Gargan. This brotherhood of former officers threatened journalists that if they reported the story from Nick Gargan's point of view, they, quote, better watch their back, and that they would, quote, have their careers destroyed. BBC took these threats so seriously that journalists at White Ladies Road had BBC Security Group protection brought down from London for the duration of the campaign by Colin Port to oust Nick Gargan. I mean, just as a bit of background on Colin Port, he was involved, Martin, as you might know, with the Rosemary Nelson inquiry, a three-year-long inquiry after she died. She was shot in... This is Rosemary Nelson. Yeah, sorry, bombed in Northern Ireland. She was a Republican lawyer in 1999. Colin Port ran the inquiry for nearly 3 years, from 1999 to 2002, from Lurgan Police Station, the very same police station where the death threats against her had been coming from, there was an MI5 car seen at the scene of the bombing, but Colin in those 3 years found absolutely nothing in his investigation. So an interesting character, Colin Port, and I'm quite worried that the campaign that he led, not him necessarily personally, was threatening journalists.
Well, I think anybody doing something like that who threatens journalists deserves it to be exposed on shows like this, and they deserve to be exposed for what they are. You shouldn't go around threatening journalists if you don't agree with what they say. And that, of course, was one of the issues in Northern Ireland. I mean, journalists were generally regarded by all sides as beyond, you know, basically safe, although that wasn't the case with... what was the name?
Martin O'Hagan.
Martin O'Hagan.
That was after the...
Yeah, but he was the only journalist that was ever killed by loyalist paramilitaries, again, in collusion with the security forces, according to Panorama. And just a clarification, of course, Rosemary Nelson was not a Republican lawyer. She was an independent lawyer who represented Republican activists. Mm. So she wasn't, in fact, an activist herself. She was an independent lawyer. But she was a successful one, which is why she was targeted by the IEC Special Branch based at Lurgan, but not according to Colin Port. Although what subsequently happened is Colin Port was taken off the case, and others of a more with a more critical eye were brought in to look into it. But of course, there's still been no real investigation of all of these incidents in Northern Ireland.
I wonder what you make of this whole debacle of the last 18 months, with the former chief constable being suspended, then found effectively innocent that he can have his job back, and then still being removed. I mean, false accusations against the chief constable led to this whole fishing operation in the first place. Former police officers showing contempt for the rule of law, really, and exhibiting behaviour identical to that of organised crime. I mean, with making threats,
I mean,
this
I
kind
don't
of thing.
Don't know it all about it all in depth. But what I do know, it is has not helped the image of the police in this area. And by the fact that it went on and on and on, it's ended up making the public feel that there's less respect for the police. And that's worrying, because they are out there doing a job and needing to do some of the things that we wouldn't do ourselves, and yet at the same time there's all this mud being slung around which they can't avoid because they are part of the force that it's coming from.
One of the things, Jenny, that I've come across, a lot of people have said to me along with similar lines, are that, you know, Sue Mount-Steams is a perfectly nice woman, but been out of her depth, swimming in a sea of sharks as a police and crime commissioner.
Yeah, you would say that. I can't say that because I don't know enough. I know some about the police, and I will tell you that I think that there are very good police and there are some that I would rather avoid. But then I can say that about all walks of life in this city.
Martin, what about this whole business of police and crime commissioners?
Well, I mean, it was just an accident waiting to happen from my point of view. It was a back of an envelope decision by the government to bring in police and crime commissioners. They certainly weren't brought in Northern Ireland, as we were discussing earlier.
Well, it's interesting,
isn't it, politicised
Sue was
the police force.
Because she hasn't got a political party to back her up. She's almost on her own there.
Well, indeed, but as you pointed out, she's got very strong connections with the business community through her husband and so on. The fact is, she hasn't really got a mandate. Only about 14% of the population participated in the election for police and crime commissioners. She won that election, but does that give her the moral authority to lose two chief constables, as she apparently has done? And I think ultimately the police and crime commissioner idea was a stupid idea. What we're trying to do in Northern Ireland, for example, is make the police above politics, so that they are genuinely independent, not on the side of one side or the other of the community. And nobody would have even thought of bringing in police and crime commissioners in Northern Ireland. So why have we brought them in Bristol? Why have we brought them in Britain? What it really means is that policing is becoming politicised, and we're now seeing the results of that in losing two, not one, two chief constables. And that, of course, is a problem for morale, it's a problem for management, and it's basically a shambles.
So she was elected on the say-so to kind of get rid of the old guard, bring in a new, almost like a new broom, new pair of hands, and then she's been sort of just overruled effectively, and Colin Port, the former chief constable who represents the old guard, has won in his campaign to oust Nick Gargan. A bit bizarre anyway. Let's move on to discuss these park bylaws, because a really interesting story in the BBC last week. The Evening Post had a kind of watered down version, but the BBC actually did put some of the real nitty gritty details. This is about new bylaws. The plans are to introduce them in a vote on the 15th of December at Bristol City Council. These are bylaws for the parks, and this was originally introduced May last year, but considered too contentious. It's now been looked at again. A council consent would be needed for 12 activities, including building structures, lighting, fires and camping. Liberal Democrat councillor Mark Wright has raised concerns over the camping bans. This could apply to sun tents and windbreaks. Well, he doesn't mention the homeless, and there are at least 9 parks in the city centre right now that the homeless people are sleeping in, and so this looks to me as if it's going to affect the homeless more than anybody else, actually.
That will worry me. As an ex-shelter worker, sleeping rough is not fun at any time of the year, but what we really need is the people that are sleeping rough to have teams go out and meet them to ensure that they get a roof over their head, make sure that they're healthy, because sleeping rough can be very detrimental to your health.
Well, Simon Cook was on here last week. He said some of them choose to be there.
You don't choose. No, I'm sorry. Life can be so bad you just fall out of society, as it were. I've worked with homeless people. There are many reasons for people becoming homeless, by being kicked out by the family, by being losing their job and getting no finance and not able to afford to put a roof over their own head, mental illness, physical illness. I always carry with me what Gandhi said: until you know the whole of the path of someone's life, you can never judge them. And I never judge the homeless, and I would hope that the people of Bristol don't either. They need a helping hand. We need some organisation that goes out to bring them in if they will come. But I will tell you, as a shelter worker, I know that within 6 to 8 weeks some of them don't ever come back. They just die out there. And there have been deaths, I'm absolutely sure. There was a friend of mine that worked for Shelter that wrote a book, Sick to Death of Homelessness. And it's quite true. You get so ill, you stay where you are, and you just die out on the streets.
So, Martin, are you happy paying your council tax for the Bristol City Council security and civil enforcement officers to go round turfing people out of parks who are sleeping in £10 tents because it's all they've got?
Well, I think this is the way. This is what's going to happen. With the bringing in of universal credit, it is now impossible for people on benefits to get private rented accommodation, because private landlords have refuse those on benefits.
Yeah, even people with savings. Maybe
even people with savings.
Pounds,
that's right. Yeah. Now, in other words, we've got problems with housing for people on low incomes anyway. But this administrative change in universal credit is going to push a lot of people, because if you can't get private rented, that's the final resort. You can't get social housing. Many people can't get social housing, especially single people. And of course, buying houses is a make money scheme for the wealthy classes.
And the number of people in the last year that are presenting themselves as homeless to the city council has trebled.
That's just in one year.
That's in one year. It's going up right across the country.
And if that's going to happen, you can't actually have a completely, one size fits all policy on what you're going to do with people sleeping in tents in parks. You can understand why they don't want to allow tent cities to develop. But in the US, tent cities are normal. And we want to be more like the US, as the government.
The tent cities are going to be there. They're just going to be on waste ground out of the public eye.
Not necessarily. And why should we have tent cities? Why can't we build housing? Why can't we actually get... we've actually been allowed now to go for office blocks to start to produce accommodation in office blocks in the city. But we really need the mayor and all us councillors to be allowed to build.
He'll say there's not the money for it.
You're wasting money with the homeless. It's 3.2 million they're predicting in the next year to spend on homeless people. If we had roofs over their head, they could possibly get a job. They could actually start to be more independent themselves. And we as ratepayers wouldn't be paying all this money to help support people who, no fault of their own, become homeless and end up needing desperate help.
Martin, is there an element of social engineering here? Because I mean, we've talked quite a lot on this programme about the idea of this pool of unemployed people being actually quite nice for big business, because it means that they can sack people willy-nilly and there's always people begging for jobs.
Well, Gore Vidal pointed out about the US, but I think it's also true of of traditional Victorian Britain, it's not enough for people to be well off. Failure must be visible and seen to be punished. It's quite important that some people are seen to be suffering at the bottom of the pile to make sure that social discipline is maintained. And I think the actual consequences are pretty crazy. I mean, the universal credit decision by Ian Duncan Smith means that private landlords who in the past were reluctant but willing to house people on benefits, I mean, one of the biggest buy-to-let landlords in the country were Tory donors, not just voters, said that they're going to evict all British people on benefits from their properties in the southeast of England, and they're going to fill them up with East Europeans who are in work who will pay the rent. And if that's not divide and rule, I don't know what is.
Our officers are predicting that under the changes that are about to take place, we will have 500 families in the city who, it's not a case of they won't pay, they can't pay. They've looked at the budgets of the income of those families, and the larger the family is, the more likely they are to end up in complete abject poverty, and they will end up, children of the future, having to grow up in slum conditions or on the streets. Now, we don't want to walk back to the past.
Now, one of the things that this does always change as it you get an increase in homelessness and unemployment, Martin, is the power relationship between employer and employee, isn't it? The employee is going to be thinking very, very carefully about even questioning or thinking about not doing something that they're asked to by their employer. And that has changed, hasn't it, massively over the last 30 or 40 years, from the day when you used to be able to say, well, I don't like my boss, I'm going to walk out of this job and get a new one tomorrow.
Well, that's the whole point of having a full employment policy, and which is why from the Thatcher era onwards we've not pursued a full employment policy despite the propaganda. The purpose is to make sure that there is discipline at work and people have to accept conditions and wages that they wouldn't otherwise accept. But of course that leads to a situation where real wages haven't risen in Britain for a long time, and in places like the United States they haven't risen since 1973. So then what happens, of course, is people borrow money to maintain their living standard, and that works for a while until you crash, and that's what's happened. And in actual fact, inequality and low wages and lack of representation at work is ultimately economically dysfunctional. But of course it makes an awful lot of money for those who rig the system.
And
that's why they do.
Let's be quite honest, there are working class people in the past. I remember there was somebody in one of the elderly people's homes that had a plaque on the wall, and he'd worked as a dustman for 50 years. And that's a long time. He must have started as a very young man. But he was so proud of that. And when you think back, jobs like that are absolutely essential. They stop us getting typhoid and illnesses. And yet at the same time, what we've got now is a structure where short-term employment, no longer the long-term, no longer the pride that many people used to take in their jobs, and that is going to affect the society of our future.
Now, you mentioned Thatcherism, Martin, there, and that, of course, was where the big pushes for privatisation. In fact, if you go onto the Russia Today website, you'll see an article I did when Margaret Thatcher died, looking really through her career at all of the massive numbers of privatisations, things like airports, ports, BP, British Airways, through the Thatcher years, the buses, etc. And what we've heard this week is even more sackings in the privatised steel industry. And that, of course, British Steel is one of the things that was privatised by Margaret Thatcher too. So let's have a listen to that discussion between Prime Minister David Cameron and leader of the opposition Jeremy Corbyn at Prime Minister's Questions in Westminster this week.
Isn't the real problem the government doesn't actually have an industrial strategy? to protect the most important industries we have in this country. If they had, they wouldn't have had to have been dragged kicking and screaming to this house three times in the last 8 days. Thousands of jobs have already gone at risk in Redcar, Scunthorpe, Rotherham, Motherwell, Cumberslang, Wrexham, and across the West Midlands. Isn't it time for concrete action today so that there is government intervention, there is support for our industry, and we do have a viable steel industry for the long term, which this country desperately needs to have?
We do want a strong and viable steel industry, and that means taking action across all of the areas that I mentioned. Let me mention another one, energy costs. We've already put £50 million into cutting energy costs, and our plans will mean hundreds of millions of pounds extra to cut energy costs. But I have to say to the Leader of the Opposition, last week in the House of Lords, the Labour Party voted to add to energy bills by opposing the measures we're taking on wind power. So yes, we do have a strategy, we do have a plan, we should be working across party to deliver that plan. I met with the Member of Parliament for Scunthorpe and the neighbouring MPs back in November last year to make sure we could take all of the action necessary, and across each of these areas, that's exactly what we'll do.
Now, that's quite an interesting move there from the subject of the steel industry over to energy. And one of the things I noticed was that the Conservative government was blaming one of the big reasons for the close down of the steel industry here in Britain over the last few weeks simply was that the price of electricity here is too high, Martin.
Well, that's what they claim. I mean, ultimately, what Corbyn is talking about there is having an overall industrial strategy. And that is what we basically lack in this country. In Germany and Japan, they don't have 5-year plans, they have 15-year plans. We don't believe in any of that. We've sold off our steel industry to international, the Tata brothers in India. You can't just pick and choose individual little industries like that. Once you run up against an obstacle like this, you can't solve it just by chucking money at it. But we haven't got a strategy.
Basically, well, another thing is they're blaming the EU. They're saying that the EU rules prevent them from intervening to save the steel industry.
Well, that's not necessarily the case. I believe that in fact the iron and steel community was what the EU was originally based on. So in actual fact they tried to regularise industrial strategy across the EU.
Coal and steel, actually.
Yeah. But the point is that we have basically the economy in Britain is run for the benefit of property owners in the southeast of England and the City of London. They determine the policy on interest rates, on benefits, on export strategy, and so on. And that is why north of the Wash, where most of the industry in this country was located, has been decimated over the last 30 years because there's been no real interest or concern. I mean, let's face it, people in Scunthorpe don't vote Tory, so if they're all thrown on the scrap heap, what difference does it make to the electoral calculations of George Osborne and his chums? The answer is none at all.
Jenny, does this, we heard this week Tata Steel as well as other companies now confirms 1,200 job losses, the industry crisis deepens. We're also hearing that one of the biggest problems is that really cheap Chinese steel is being dumped on the international markets because of the general slump in the world economy.
That's right,
the Chinese have decided if you're going to buy your steel from anybody, you're going to buy it from us.
And it's not such a good quality, the papers are telling us. But looking at the whole thing that's going on at the moment and people blaming Europe, then you've got to ask yourself why many European countries have been able to maintain their industries like this and have maintained them all the way through the time that this government of ours have been in power and slowly destroying the structure of our economy. We no longer make things anymore. And Mrs. Thatcher started that, and we were so proud of the inventiveness of our country. That's all slipped away. And the Europeans have held on to many of their industries, and they are ticking over and providing work for ordinary people.
which we don't seem to be providing now.
Yeah, it does seem a criminal shame that these enormous plants are just mothballed and then bulldozed. And you know what? They're turned into housing. Anyway, it came up again. Steel and Prime Minister's questions as well.
Mr. Nick Dakin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Did the Prime Minister make clear to the Chinese President the urgent need to stop Chinese steel dumping? And if so, what was the response? And will he meet once again with North Lincolnshire MPs to see what further can be done to support steelmaking in Scunthorpe?
I'm glad that the Honourable Member was at the summit on Friday. I met with him back in November, always happy to meet again with him and neighbouring MPs. When this question time finishes, I'm going straight to number 10 for several hours of talks with the Chinese President, and there's every opportunity to talk about this issue. I began those discussions last night, where I think the Chinese do recognise that they've got a huge overcapacity in their own steel industry, and that's an issue they have to address as well. But let me say again, I don't want to make promises I can't keep. We can't set the steel price here in this house. We can't set the steel price here in this house. And we can't go beyond the sorts of steps I've talked about on procurement, on energy, on industrial support. But let me just remind members opposite, they might like to remember something of their own record. Under Labour, steel production halved. Under Labour, employment in steel halved. Since I've been Prime Minister, steel production has gone up and steel employment has stayed at the same level. So before we get a self-righteous lecture from the party opposite, look at your own record.
Well, I mean, the new Labour basically continued the deindustrialisation policies of the Tories. We didn't have an industrial strategy under Labour either, and that's because we in Britain, dominated as we are by property owners in the southeast of England and the City of London, don't believe in industrial strategies, which is why the Prime Minister is cobbling together a series of measures that he's talking about, trying to persuade the Chinese not to dump their steel and what have you. Now, the real problem, of course, is that we are moving into a deflationary wave where the Chinese will carry on pushing steel possibly at less than its costs of production because they don't want to close their steel plants. So everybody then starts producing steel at less than its cost of production, and gradually we're moving towards another crash. And it will, even though stock markets around the world are at their highest ever, despite the summer's gyrations, because of quantitative easing, we are going to hit the wall at 90 miles an hour here. And at the end of the summer, when we've done that, people will begin to realise what a disaster the deregulation of the financial markets and the lack of an industrial policy actually is.
Just about some more details on this Tata Steel collapse. The Indian conglomerate has been trying to offload its Scunthorpe-based long products division since a sale to the billionaire industrialist Gary Klesh, owner of the Klesh Group of Industrial Commodities. He's saying actually that the commodity markets collapsed in August. What I mean, this is something that we don't necessarily hear about, but the steel price collapsed. They're saying basically it's gone down to almost nothing.
That's because
just in August. Why was that?
Because we've got a deflationary wave. There's overproduction given the level of demand in the world economy because of the crash of 2008. It's been kept going on life support by quantitative easing in Britain and elsewhere. This is going to unwind very rapidly.
But why has demand? Soon. Okay, so there's two things happened. The price of steel's gone down, but obviously demand has gone down too. The Chinese have decided to cut their price to virtually nothing, so that anybody that's buying steel is buying from them.
Well, exactly, and that's what happens when you get to this stage of the game. People don't want to close their steel plants down, so they sell at less than cost of production just to stay in the game. But that, of course, then forces other people to cut their prices, which then makes demand in the global economy less. Don't forget, in Scunthorpe, nobody's going to be buying any new stuff any time in the near future, and so it goes. And there's going to be a major crash worse than 2008. Nobody's talking about this in the mainstream political spectrum, certainly not people like the SNP, for example, who seem to want to talk a radical game but don't quite understand the implications. There's going to be a major crash, and then of course we're going to have to ask ourselves real questions about the distribution of wealth and power in the society.
Okay, staying with Prime Minister's questions, local MP here, Jacob Rees-Mogg, was brought up the subject of working tax credits.
Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Yeah.
Mr. Speaker.
Yeah.
Does my right honourable friend share my concern that if the other place were to vote against working tax credits, this would be a serious challenge to the privilege of this House, a privilege codified as long ago as 1678? And does he further share my concern that this would then entitle him to review the decisions of Grey and Asquith in relation to creating more peers to ensure the government can get its financial business through?
I think my honourable friend makes an important point. His knowledge of history is clearly better than mine. I thought the key date was the 1911 Parliament Act, but clearly under that Act it's supposed to be that issues of finance are decided in this House. Now this House has now decided twice in favour of this measure, once when voting on the statutory instrument, again last night in a vote put forward by the opposition, and I think the House of Lords should listen to that very carefully and recognise that it's for this House to make financial decisions, it's for the other House to revise other legislation.
That's moral blackmail, isn't it? What they're actually saying is if you don't behave yourselves and vote what we want you to vote and not use your brains and think it through by yourself, then we actually will pack the House of Lords with more and more members, which will cost us ratepayers more money to keep more people in the House of Lords, and at the same time destroy what little democracy there is left in that House.
Well, the fact is, I mean, as I understand it, they are, in a sense, technically correct that finance bills cannot be overturned by the House of Lords according to the 1911 Convention. But also, the cutting of tax credits was not in the Conservative manifesto.
Yeah.
And that is the line that's being taken by independent peers, not necessarily by Labour peers in the House of Lords, that it wasn't in your manifesto. And because it wasn't in your manifesto, you don't actually have a mandate to do it. And therefore, we are in a position to say you shouldn't do it. And I notice with pleasure that various Conservative MPs have spoken out against the measure because they can see that their constituents are going to suffer.
And some lawyers are saying this could be a constitutional crisis because there's no precedent for this.
Well, indeed. And of course, the British House of Lords is the biggest chamber on the planet, bar only one, the Chinese People's Assembly, which represents nearly 2 billion people and has 1,000 and some odd members. British House of Lords has hundreds of members, far more than the House of Commons. But nobody wants to reform it because ultimately, basically, it's the cornerstone of the undemocratic constitution of our country.
Well, some people have talked about this working tax credits business as being the poll tax for Cameron in only a few months after he's elected this May. And it came up again in Prime Minister's questions.
Jo Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Food bank use has risen by 1,665% since the Prime Minister took office in 2010. And in Cardiff Central, I meet people every week who rely on food banks to feed their families. Does the Prime Minister know how many more families will be relying on food banks as a result of his government's cuts to tax credits? And does he care?
Yeah.
Well, what is happening in her constituency is the number of people claiming unemployment benefit is down 20% in the last year. The youth claimant count has fallen almost 20% in the last year, and the long-term youth unemployment has fallen in the last year by 38%. That is what is happening. Of course, I don't want anyone in our country to have to rely on food banks, but the right answer is a growing economy, creating jobs, higher wages, the national living wage, and cutting taxes. That's what we're delivering, and that's how to help Britain's families.
How many of those unemployed people have come off the unemployment benefit register only to end up in a food bank? And many people in work are using food banks. So all of this kind of sleight of hand is extremely disingenuous. But of course, as I stressed earlier, there's going to be a further crash. The property bubble is going to burst. And at a certain point, unemployment, measured unemployment, is going to increase in this country. And at that point, all of the huffing and puffing from the central government saying that you can find a job if you want. How many jobs are people going to get in Scunthorpe after these plants have closed? The answer is hardly any. That's the reality.
Well, the fact is, less than were there before. Far less, not just at the steel plant, but all the knock-on effects. In fact, you're going to end up with a town, Scunthorpe, I think, isn't it, with actually no purpose to be there.
But the unemployment figures have already been slowly easing upwards, haven't they?
They have.
So that this will compound it and make it even worse. We are going to have people coming down from the north who are absolutely destitute that will make our problems with the people that are sleeping on our street that are being ignored even worse.
Martin, how do we get ourselves a money system that serves the public rather than, you know, where the public are expected to serve it? And what point did it change? Because it must have something to do with, you know, the idea of everyone's got a job, full employment in the 1970s, for example. Now it's completely the opposite. And we always all seem to be so in the thrall of these kind of new feudal lords, the bankers.
Well, I mean, from 1945 to around 1975, all across the Western world, there was a policy of governments of every stripe of having a full employment policy, which basically gave the whip hand to employers rather than employees rather than employers, and raised wages year on year in line with productivity. We broke with that and deregulated financial markets 10 years later, and then built up the biggest credit bubble in history, which burst in 2008. It's been reinflated since then, but it's going to burst again, and this time there won't be any government intervention which will be able to mitigate the consequences through quantitative easing. We'll have to go straight to redistribution, major redistribution, because of course what quantitative easing and the intervention in the financial markets implies is that there is no longer a market allocation of resources, so the ideological justification for excessive wealth is simply gone. So in other words, if we start prosecuting the banks properly for the illegal behaviours that they've engaged in and sending people to prison and confiscating their assets, that's how you deal with the deficit. In other words, you put them in prison, you take their money off them, and you pay for new houses for poor people out of that money.
Well, one of the things I would certainly point to is the organised finance capital right across the Western world that's now... It does seem to take any notice of national borders, and in fact a lot of national governments are struggling to cope with a much bigger overarching power, which is largely to do with the arms companies, the banks, and oil and those other sorts of industries, who are actually far bigger than they are. And these politicians that we're dealing with, that we have on this show from day to day, are actually quite a long way down the food chain. We had the sad death this week of the MP Michael Meacher, who was somebody who'd really got his head around this, the Labour MP for Oldham. So I thought we'd have a listen to something that he had to say about all this, because he came, as we did, Martin, back in 2013 to the Bilderberg conference, and here he is talking about it all, if you've not heard about it before, on Sky News.
By George Osborne and Ed Balls, as well as CEOs and royalty from around the world, but no minutes are taken and no press are allowed. Well, let's cross live to Watford now and speak to the Labour MP, Michael Meacher. A very good morning to you. An awful lot of people won't even have heard of the Bilderberg Group. So can you give us an idea of what's going on in Watford there today?
After the scandals which we heard about in the Lords last week, David Cameron said he was going to set up measures to ensure that there was proper regulation of lobbyists and in particular transparency. If there is any conference which required transparency, which required democratic accountability, it is the Bilderberg conference, because this is really where the top brass of Western finance capitalism meet in order to make their deals, listen to each other, lobby, including government ministers, particularly George Osborne and Kenneth Clark. And as far as I know, there will be no statement in the House following it saying what happened and how it might affect government policy. This is totally in contradiction to the government's commitment to have greater transparency. George Osborne said in 2010 that he was committed to the most transparent agenda this country had ever seen. And Kenneth Clark said that transparency was the best protection against corruption that any country could have. So why can't we have transparency over the Bilderberg conference?
Well, some might argue that there's nothing wrong with having a forum for open debate that's off the record. These people can't make laws after all, and they might argue it's useful to allow unfettered debate. People can be candid without fear of reprisal. And don't meetings go on all the time behind closed doors with business leaders and politicians and other politicians?
Well, I mean, of course these people have a right to meet. Everyone has a right to meet. They actually regularly meet every year at Davos in Switzerland. The difference there is that the public and the press have access, and therefore it is properly and fully recorded. In this case, there is very closely guarded secrecy. They have their own charity called, notoriously, the Bilderberg Association, which uses charity fund in order to get the local police to ensure that absolutely nobody else has access. This is the complete opposite of transparency and openness and democratic government, which they say they believe in. And this is the most important gathering of the most powerful people in Western capitalism that there is. So instead of trying to manipulate the new laws on lobbying against the trade union, although they are the most democratic and open organisation you can find in Britain, why don't you apply it to the people who really have power, really have wealth, and really influence the decisions in this and other European countries?
Well, the Bilderberg Group occupies a very bizarre interstice, as it were, between the public and the private. And what happened in Watford, in fact, was that the local town council had to pick up half the bill for policing the Bilderberg Group, even though it was supposedly a private meeting. If it was a private meeting, they should have picked up 100% of the bill. And the other thing that happened, of course, is that George Osborne went to Bilderberg in on the continent a couple of years ago, and he took his Treasury civil servants with him. In other words, we paid for the Treasury civil servants to go to the meeting, and he then had the brass neck in the House of Commons to defend his participation, saying it was a private meeting. Well, if it was a private meeting, why have you taken your Treasury civil servants with them? Now, Michael Meacher, who's died this week, and you know, full credit to him, he actually was the very first MP to put down a motion in the House of Commons after that Bilderberg meeting in Watford, saying, I want a report back from all the members of the government who attended, and we want to know what was discussed. Because you can have meetings of industrialists if you like, but if elected politicians turn up there, especially with their civil servants, I want a report back. Otherwise, they shouldn't be there.
Well, the other problem, of course, is you get people that own massive media corporations also there, and they don't say anything about what's happened in those publications. No. People like Rupert Murdoch's group, etc. Jenny, Michael Meacher, I think he was Environment Secretary, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a wonderful person. He thought ahead. He had the trust of many of us. He cared about the environment. He cared about the fact that the future of the planet is threatened by what we're doing with the environment. He appointed me to the Wessex Environment Agency, and we had so much in common, and whenever we met, we knew that we were like brains and hearts coming into a room, because we were caring about the next generation in the world, if there is a world left for them to live in.
Martin, where did he stand in the party? Because I know he was a Privy Councillor. I think he even served under Harold Wilson's government.
He was actually the longest serving Labour cabinet minister, because he'd served in various administrations, including the Blair administration. But nevertheless, an extremely radical character. Willing to challenge the consensus on many issues. For example, I remember that he wrote one of the most critical accounts of what happened on 9/11, saying this war on terror is bogus. And basically, he turned up to the Bilderberg protest, for example, where no other elected politician but put in an appearance. And that just showed to a younger generation, because there were several hundreds of a younger generation there, that the Labour Party was meaningful and purposeful, and actually was prepared to stand up to big power. And of course, the Bilderberg Group has been accused directly by the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, of being behind all the terrorism in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s.
Okay, one of the weird things about the death of Michael Meacher was the deletion of his Twitter account, because I followed him on Twitter over the last 3 or 4 years. I've read some fantastic articles, one of which was just last week by Brian Gould, who was writing, and his last tweet was actually about keeping the Socialist Workers' Party away from the Labour Party. So I managed to, the Twitter account had been deleted, but I managed to get a copy of it, and I put that up online. So if anyone would like to see Michael Meacher's last 20 tweets, I'll put a link on our show page at thisweek.org. Uk.
Let's be quite honest, he was a friend of Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour Councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith. After the Murdoch News, the latest James Bond film, but we have a different take.
2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Britain.